Welcome everybody to a Friday live stream. We hope everyone is doing well. We hope you had a good week and everyone is gearing up for a good weekend. Hopefully you guys aren't in lockdown and this weekend you guys can move around or maybe go to a restaurant or a cafe. Us here in Cyprus, unfortunately, we are not that lucky. But anyway, we'll do some more live streams this weekend, maybe post some videos and about some news. Maybe we'll do a live stream on the Putin press conference, which was really interesting. He said some really, really interesting things about Navalny, a really interesting line about Navalny and about the United States as well. So maybe we'll do a live stream on that. Alexander, how are you doing this Friday?
I'm very well, extremely pleased to be together with our viewers again. And it's been an interesting week. And we are, as you correctly say, moving towards Christmas now. And we're already gearing up to start our Christmas meals and preparations. Tomorrow, my Christmas goose arrives. I prefer goose for Christmas than turkey. It's perhaps more British to have goose than turkey, but you know, and I have a Victorian recipe, which I always use, which cooks it with marmalade and all sorts of things like that. So it's going to be something I'm very much looking forward to.
Christmas is coming soon.
Christmas is coming very, very soon after an extraordinary year. And can I just say, my strong prediction is that 2021, all of these problems we've been having, which have caused all those lockdowns, are going to start to recede, not just because of the treatments that people are talking about, because also the politics are going to make it more difficult. Now, that's a statement which I know many people will probably diverge from, and we can perhaps look at it later, but that's my view. So I think we are looking in that respect to a better 2021.
Interesting. All right. Well, I'm a little more pessimistic, I think. With a smile. I mean, I'm optimistic. I'm happy. And we should all be happy.
I know.
We'll be okay. We will be okay. Yes, so good morning to everybody that's sending me a good morning. If you are waking up, or good afternoon. Mm-hmm. Hello to everyone in Warsaw, in South Africa, in Australia. How is everyone doing in Australia? Hi, Cheryl. How are you? Hello, Helen. How are you doing? Let's see where else. Real quick, we'll just jump right into it because we have three kinds of – hello to everyone in Algeria. We have three topics, Alexander, which are kind of interconnected in a way, in an interesting way, actually. And hello to everyone in Amsterdam. So let's do it. Let's get into some interesting news here. Let's talk first about Justice Roberts. Alexander, and about, I think it was two live streams ago, you said that you believed, you didn't have any information or anything, but in your experience in dealing with high courts, you said that you believed the ruling with Texas, we're going to go back to the Supreme Court ruling with Texas and the fact that it wasn't really a ruling, the fact that they decided not to rule on it at all and just kind of pass the buck back to the states and say, we don't want to deal with it. You said that you believed that behind closed doors, there was probably some very heated exchanges and a lot of arguments whether to take the case or not. You just said you had that hunch in your experience with high courts. And now we're starting to get rumors. They're not confirmed, but we are starting to get rumors and various prominent lawyers like Lynn Wood, who tweeted yesterday, that he believes there were arguments and that it was Chief Justice Roberts who was the driving force to make sure the Supreme Court did not take the case. And there has been, and we don't know if it's true, there has been a clerk who has sent an email out to various media personalities, and Lynn Wood has also seen that email. We don't know if there really is a clerk, if that really was a Supreme Court clerk or not. We can't confirm that either. But that Supreme Court clerk pretty much confirms what you said. That person said that they were sitting at a desk and they could hear through the walls a huge, huge argument between all the justices. They note that usually it's very calm and there's no, you know, huge disputes taking place. But in this instance with Texas, the Supreme Court justices were just going at it. And it was indeed Roberts who who banned, who blocked any hearing to take place with the with Texas. And when they left the chambers, that clerk said that he or she noticed that Roberts and Kavanaugh, let me get the exact quote here, that Roberts, when they left the room, Roberts, the Labs, and Kavanaugh had big smiles. Alito and Thomas were visibly upset. ACB and Gorsuch didn't seem fazed at all. Alexander, what do you make of this? Once again, we can't confirm this, but it does fall in line with your knowledge of the court system and how you probably saw much of this going down when the Texas case was brought up to the Supreme Court.
I think it's very plausible. I want to make it very clear. I don't know who this person, this clerk, is, or whether this person actually is a clerk, or whether this isn't just internet rumor or anything like that. I mean, it could very well be. But again, I would be extremely surprised. I would have been astonished if there had not been arguments and disagreements over this decision. Now, I want to make one thing absolutely clear. The decision that we're talking about is not a decision whether to agree with Texas or to disagree with Texas. That argument was never even heard. The issue was whether to accept the case that Texas was bringing, backed by, I think it was 18 other states, should even be considered at all. That, I have to say, astonished me when they decided that they should not hear that case, because the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court was to look at disputes between states. It seemed to me that this fell fully within that jurisdiction. And without going into too much detail, I felt very clearly that, you know, since what happened in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan clearly had an effect on what happened in places like Texas and in other states, the argument that this somehow was a purely internal question for some states, which didn't really impact on others, just didn't hold any kind of water at all. Now, I'm not saying if the Supreme Court had decided to hear the case, it would have been up to them to make a decision. They could have listened to the whole case. They could have said that Texas's views were misplaced. They could have even said that, you know, Texas has brought this case, but this was an internal development within Pennsylvania. That would have been a decision. And the Supreme Court has a right to decide however it chooses. But they did something completely different. They refused even to hear the case. And I find that extraordinary. We know two justices, Alito and Clarence Thomas, disagreed. And they obviously disagreed strongly because they published a dissenting opinion about it. They said that they would not grant any other relief. They would not have granted any other relief because, given that the case had not even been heard, how could they even contemplate granting relief? But they did make it clear that they thought the Supreme Court should have heard the case. Now, I think that is a very controversial decision. I think that is the Supreme Court abdicating responsibility. And I think that Clarence Thomas and Alito were perfectly right. And I find it all but impossible to believe that this would not have resulted in bitter arguments and exchanges. I, as you correctly say, have experience of judges, not in the United States, obviously, but in Britain. And I can say that when judges feel strongly about an issue, they will express themselves in very forthright terms to each other. Now, there is another thing to say, which is that, of course, before the election, there was a string of cases on constitutional issues which went to the Supreme Court, including one on Pennsylvania. And it was striking again that the Supreme Court ducked out of making substantive decisions on any of those cases, especially the Pennsylvania case. That attracted some critical commentary from jurists, from people, from legal commentators like National Review's Andrew McCarthy. Now, bear in mind, National Review has been very critical of Trump in the last few weeks, but Andrew McCarthy, who is their main legal commentator, and who has gone along with much of that criticism now, thought before the election and still thinks now that that decision to duck out of making a decision by the Supreme Court on Pennsylvania was wrong. And apparently, in his latest articles, he still thinks it. So there is a pattern here, and Roberts is the key person because, of course, he's the Chief Justice. He basically leads the others. He's the person who makes many of the decisions, the administrative decisions about how the court should work, you know, the listings of cases and things of that kind. So he carries a great deal of sway. And clearly, and this is Andrew McCarthy now that I'm citing in his critical commentaries before the election, Roberts has been intimidated. That's McCarthy's view. And what McCarthy was focusing on was the fact that there was all that talk about enlarging the Supreme Court by the Democrats, bringing in more justices. And McCarthy's point was that even if there was no reality behind that threat, it was one which had clearly intimidated some of the justices, including Roberts. And rather than face up to their responsibility to make difficult decisions, which might be controversial, they were ducking those decisions because they were worried that unless they did so, the position of the Supreme Court might actually be challenged. Now, what we hear from these rumors, and I have to call them rumors, is that Roberts was even worried about the fact that there'd been rioting in parts of the United States, and that this was making him even more concerned about leading, as he said, apparently, the Supreme Court into controversy. What I think he needs to understand is that a Supreme Court that ducks decisions, that won't take responsibility, that won't state its views clearly, is also a court that is leading itself into controversy, that it may have pleased some people, it will have angered many others, and that a Supreme Court that refuses to take responsibility becomes a Supreme Court which many people start to think is not fit for purpose. So he has appeased, if this is what has happened, and it looks as if it is, he has appeased those who are hostile to the Supreme Court, but only to a very limited extent, because they will come back and they will demand more. If you appease your enemies, that is what they will do. But in the process, he has upset and demoralized that section of American society, which are the Supreme Court's traditional supporters.
All right. Excellent summation. Alexander, Spartan Warrior Queen, our awesome moderator. Good to have you here. I saw you in the live feed, in the live chat. The best moderator in all of YouTube. And guys, remember to hit that like as you enter. Just do us a big solid. Hit that like. The easiest thing to do. Let's get this this video to 1,000 likes so that the YouTube algorithms, maybe the YouTube algorithms will promote this video. Maybe. We'll see. They don't promote much of ours, but maybe they'll promote this one. So, Alexander, I'm going to read you a tweet from Lynn Wood. Mm. And this is going to tie into the arrest of Jean-Luc Brunel, I believe it'll tie into. Once again, we don't have confirmation on all these things, but I think there is a common thread, and you can elaborate on that. It'll tie into the arrest of Jean-Luc Brunel and Peter Nygaard, which happened pretty much day after day. I mean, consecutive arrests of these guys who are connected to Epstein. In one a little more loosely connected, the other one is deeply connected. Brunel is deeply connected with Epstein. And of course, we also have in the backdrop an Attorney General Barr, who is no longer Attorney General, or at least soon he will no longer be Attorney General. So maybe you could elaborate on that. That might factor in. But why I'm going to read you the Lynn Wood tweets is because Lynn Wood is doing the tying in for me. And once again, I'm just reading directly from what Attorney Lynn Wood tweeted. We don't have confirmation of this, and we don't know if the name on the manifest really is Roberts. Yeah. I don't know. You don't know. No one knows. It could be anybody. Yeah. But this is what Lynn Wood tweeted, and I'm reading it exactly as Lynn Wood says it. Mm-hmm. I have long had questions about, quote, and he puts this in quotes, Alexander, the John Roberts. He's an attorney. He's putting it in quotes. On Jeffrey Epstein private jet flight logs. I suspected it was our Chief Justice. MSM, mainstream media, has shown no interest in investigating issue to find truth. America is now entitled to know the answer. Every lie will be revealed. Pray. Mm. So that is the tweet from Lynn Wood. He sent a lot of tweets yesterday, and he was crushing Roberts. Mm. But Lynn Wood brings it up. He puts it in quotes. He says, the John Roberts on the flight logs, the Epstein flight logs. We have this week two huge arrests of two very powerful multimillionaire billionaires. Canada's Peter Nygaard, who's a fashion tycoon and apparel mogul. And we have Jean-Luc Brunel, who's a modeling agency tycoon, who worked hand in hand with Epstein, actually was a partner of Epstein's. Mm-hmm. And he's been he was being investigated, and they say he was working with Epstein to do a lot of recruiting, I guess, is for lack of a better word. He was arrested in Paris, I believe, during a flight he was looking to take. But Barr is on his way out, and we have all of this happening. What do you make of this, Alexander?
Well, first of all, can I just say about the Roberts thing? I mean, that isn't evidence. That's just a speculation on Lynn Wood's part. I have to say that legally speaking, it carries absolutely no weight whatsoever. It does show how angry some people are with Chief Justice Roberts. But I mean, that's all I'm going to say about that. But coming to the other things, it is very interesting how the web of investigation around the Epstein affair, and I'm still going to call it the Epstein affair because he still remains, it seems to me, at the center of all of this, is now expanding. And it's expanding internationally. So we've now got two very important people, both in the fashion world, in that kind of world, one of them immensely rich, and one of them apparently extremely well-connected. They're now being sucked in. They're now under investigation. They're under arrest. One of them has been arrested in Paris, which is a sign that this investigation is now getting it's developing international ramifications. Bear in mind, by the way, Paris is one of the world capitals of fashion. Ghislaine Maxwell at one time had an apartment there. Robert Maxwell, her father, was very well connected to France. These are just connections. I'm just making them. And it looks as if the Epstein affair is expanding. It looks as if energy has now finally come to the investigations. And one point where I completely agree with Lynn Wood, please let us find out who all of these people who were involved are. I think we need to have clarity about who actually is involved, both to trace the guilty and to protect the innocent, so that, you know, people are not embarrassed because their name happens to coincide with someone else. But those people who really are guilty are tracked down and brought to justice. Now, it may be, it's entirely possible that the fact that Barr is leaving has some connection to this, because I've never got the impression that there's been a huge amount of energy behind this case. But things are now starting to happen. Possibly. We shall see. Ghislaine, by the way, is trying to get bail again. She's putting up $22.5 million bail money, or rather her husband is. Bear in mind, this is the person who was telling us a few weeks ago that she was completely out of cash and that she was completely broke, basically. She's now suddenly discovered that she can lay her hands on $22.5 million. So it doesn't look as if she's that broke. But that's the news on that front. But as I said, other people are becoming involved. And in one case, I was interested to see that one of these two people who've now been arrested, I mentioned this as a Briton, it turns out that they are on friendly terms with a well-known person in Britain, our very own Prince Andrew, or at least Peter that's Nygaard. Exactly, Peter Nygaard. Those are the reports that are circulating in the media. There doesn't seem to be any convincing denial of them. And so we will see what that happens, because obviously Prince Andrew's position is looking ever more shaky with every passing day.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that so Peter Nygaard now, he's in Winnipeg. He's been arrested. He's waiting for extradition to the United States. Interestingly enough, once again, the Southern District of New York, it was, if I'm not mistaken, the SDNY that was they were the ones involved in Epstein as well. What do you make of that? Just coincidence or also something to look at?
No, it's not a coincidence. It strongly suggests that all of these investigations are connected to each other, that Nygaard and Epstein are possibly being investigated by the same team, that it all centers on New York, not just on New York, by the way, but on Manhattan, because that's the area which is basically covered by the Southern District of New York. The fact that it's been done by the U.S. Attorney's Office at the Southern District of New York shows that it's federal crimes which are being investigated also. And the fact that we've had arrests in Paris and in Canada, again, shows that this is an international investigation also. It is increasingly looking as if this is an international web of people all connected to each other, all engaging in the same or similar activities, and that this is being investigated from New York by the US Attorney's Office there, and that they're putting all the pieces together. It is extremely important to say at this stage in any investigation that every person who is arrested is entitled to the presumption of innocence. So we're not saying that either of these people as yet, have been proved to be guilty of anything. But in the case, of course, of Epstein, he actually pleaded guilty. I know that this is an important fact because some people like Alan Dershowitz have been trying, I noticed, to try and cast some doubt on that by attacking Virginia Roberts and, making out that her stories have changed on several occasions. But Epstein himself actually, at a time when Dershowitz was acting for him, pleaded guilty. So it looks as if there is a lot of substance to this case. In fact, there's no doubt that there is. And the scope of those investigations, or I suspect actually the scope of the investigation, I think there's only one, is widening, and more people are involved. And in Nygaard's case, we're talking about an exceptionally rich man, and it's international. They all seem to have had shared interests, and it focuses on Manhattan and New York. So all connected, all together, all working together, same people involved with each other, focused on New York. This is not a coincidence.
In the affidavit to extradite Nygaard from Winnipeg, they mentioned the arrest of Nygaard, and they've been investigating his co-conspirators. He has been doing this, they say, for 25 years. He's been in Canada, in the U.S., multiple homes in the U.S., in Canada, And he's been doing this for 25 years, the trafficking that he's been involved in. I read the Daily Mail article, and they're digging in deep on this. Once again, they dug in deep on Epstein, and they're digging in deep on Nygaard and Brunel. On Nygaard, the parallels between Nygaard and Epstein are absolutely stunning. Nygaard also has this huge estate in the Bahamas, a very strange structure with volcanoes that go off at night and statues of cobras that hiss as you walk by. You also have many celebrities visiting Nygaard, and they would partake in parties that Nygaard would call, and I think I'm going to get this right, pamper parties. And of course, the recruiting in the same style of Epstein, in that Nygaard would use other girls to recruit other girls, very much like Epstein. And of course, the Daily Mail ties it all together with photos of Nygaard and Andrew walking around the estate. To be fair, Andrew's PR or press arm has said that he's not friends with Nygaard. They only met once. He's not even an associate. But I think the Daily Mail is hinting that they've got a lot more, including multiple meetings and the fact that Andrew did stay with him at his, I believe it was the Bahamas residence as well. Right. So I think Daily Mail is going to come out with a lot more on Andrew's connection to Nygaard. Of course, everyone knows Andrew's connection to Epstein. What do you make of that? Co-conspirator photos, celebrities. This is like a copy paste here of Epstein.
It's a copy paste, and it's such a copy paste that I wonder whether I'm fairly sure that these are connected. That these are connected things. That we're going to discover that one of those co-conspirators is actually dead, and that is a certain gentleman who hanged himself, or so we're told, a few months ago. Was it a year ago? In circumstances that have provoked so much controversy. I am sure that Nygaard and Epstein knew each other, knew what each was doing, and I am sure that they were working in parallel with one another, always assuming, of course, that these allegations against Nygaard are true. And I have to always put that in parentheses because we've got always to remember that. But none of this surprises me. I'm afraid the fact that this has been going on in public or semi-public for 25 years is profoundly shocking. But after Epstein and the revelations there, it's not surprising. And it shows that there was definite impunity for this sort of thing that was going on, and that people whose job it was to exercise law enforcement were looking the other way, because that is the only explanation for it. Even if it turns out that Nygaard himself is innocent, the fact that we're talking about co-conspirators, which by the way makes it more difficult to believe that he's innocent, because that suggests a plot, and it suggests, by the way, if there's talk about co-conspirators, I just want to add this, if it talks about co-conspirators, that strongly suggests that someone, one of those co-conspirators, has turned round and has flipped and is giving evidence. So, you know, you start getting the links to build up the web. That's what it suggests to me. But even regardless of, you know, Nygaard's himself and his own case about him, the very fact that we're talking about co-conspirators suggests a very large crime. It points overwhelmingly to the fact that there are people who are guilty, that they've been allowed to do it for 25 years is shocking, but clearly it is not surprising, because that was the pattern of New York and United States law enforcement. They allowed these things to go on. They weren't concerned about them. They provided protection to these people who were doing these terrible things. And the big question is why. And that is, I think, the single most important question that has arisen out of the Epstein affair and out of this one too. So trace who was involved, punish the guilty, protect the innocent, support the victims, all that is very important. Also find out why. Why was this allowed to go on for as long as it was, with so many lives traumatized and ruined and destroyed? And who knows what other crimes were committed, which we don't know about. Because, of course, when we learn about depraved people who are able to operate with impunity for so many years, they become very confident. They begin to sense that, you know, they're somehow above the law, and that can lead them to do even worse crimes of a sort we simply can't imagine.
Yeah, and now Canada is also embroiled in this as well. 25 Absolutely. Years. What were the Canadian authorities doing?
Well, Alexander, really quick. And the British and the French. This is an international case. So what was going on? What were the connections that made this all possible? Why were these obviously very rich people able to do these things?
The most powerful and the most rich.
The most powerful and the most rich. Why were they able to do these things?
Real quick, Alexander, Paul in the live stream, I just caught this and I think Paul's making an awesome point. Actually, that's why I want to bring this to you. Paul says, if Brunel has been arrested, Jean-Luc Brunel, Maxwell is talking. Could this be the handiwork of Maxwell? Is the person that's flipping Ghislaine Maxwell?
Yes, it's quite possible. It's entirely possible. I have said consistently that Maxwell's best interests are to start giving evidence, to start disclosing facts to the prosecutors. Now, it's important to say that she is currently facing charges, and when somebody's charged, they should not be communicating directly. They should not be questioned, for example, directly by investigators anymore. But of course, she has a very strong legal team, and I'm sure that the legal team is talking, even ever so discreetly, to the other side. And who knows, they may very well be passing information, and it could very, very well be Maxwell. Not saying it is, but, you know, that's a very plausible and very astute and insightful guess. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we talked about Barr and the fact that maybe it's coincidence, maybe it isn't, but the fact that Barr seems to be getting out of the way, resigned, most likely fired, but resigned. It seems that these cases are picking up steam, and we may be getting to some truth, and we've been wanting truth on the entire Epstein thing for a while. Not everyone that's watching this wants truth and they want answers. You know, we've got momentum again. Things stopped for a while. We've got momentum again. Once again, with Barr out of the way, it looks like we may be getting a lot more momentum on Hunter Biden as well. And we've been covering this story very, very deeply. We've been covering Hunter since the very, very beginning. We are now getting calls, multiple calls from multiple powerful people in Congress, in politics, in the media, for a special counsel to be appointed to investigate Hunter Biden. We know there's a special counsel in this mysterious figure with only one photograph on the internet called John Durham, who no one's ever seen. We know that Barr appointed him special counsel in October without telling anybody, including his boss, President Trump. We've talked about why we think he did it. But now they're calling for a special counsel on Hunter Biden. That would be huge. We have texts, more texts that have been released with Hunter Biden sending an email to one of the executives at CFC, the Chinese, this cutout Chinese energy firm, which I personally don't think was really an energy firm. I think it was just a corporate honeypot to ensnare politicians. But anyway, Hunter sends an email to them and he says, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, whatever. I'm sad I missed you on your trip to the US, I'm paraphrasing, and please send me $10 million so that we can get the company up and running. And I'm going to introduce you to Tony Bobulinski next time you come to the US. So he sent this email to this Chinese executive at CFC. We also have new texts released between Gilliard, who's like the confidant of the Bidens, and Tony Bobulinski, where they talk about the formation of this company and the deals they're going to make and working with the Chinese. And they say it's absolutely important. Once again, I'm paraphrasing. It's really important that, you know, we bring in the Biden family into this, especially Joe, and they say, especially Joe. So they want to make this a family affair, obviously, for certain marketing, name recognition purposes. But they say those words, a family affair. We have to bring in Joe. I think this is the first time that we actually have a text that actually does mention Joe Biden. I mean, specifically mentions Joe Biden. So that's between Gilear and Bob Linsky. That's the extent of the new information we have. Mm-hmm. But once again, you know, we're getting more drips of texts and documents which show the Biden family, without a doubt, Hunter Biden, without a doubt, Jim Biden. But now we're getting the first, you know, inklings of a Joe Biden involved in very close communication and close business contact with CFC and the Chinese. And we are getting calls for a special counsel. And, you know, that would be a game changer. The question is if Biden and Kamala manage to weasel their way into the White House, do they have the power to just, you know, make the special counsel go away? Because in essence, you may be having a special counsel investigating the son of a would-be president of the United States. I mean, things get very tricky. Then who do you have waiting in the wings? Kamala Harris, who's probably just sitting there going, oh boy, I can't wait to sit in the Oval Office as Obama promised me, Alexander.
Right, let's first of all begin with Barb, because I just want to just tie up that loose end. I think let's put it like this: he was persuaded to leave. I think it was a resignation which he wasn't perhaps keen on, but he was persuaded to leave. Now, the important thing to remember about Barr is that this is the second time that he has been Attorney General. He was also George H.W. Bush's Attorney General. So he's been around in the law enforcement, at the top of the law enforcement system for a very long time. And if we go back briefly to the, let's call it the Epstein affair, what we're learning is that some of these events stretch back over decades. So they stretch back, it seems, to periods of time previously when Barr was Attorney General. And of course, not just Barr, but there were other Attorney Generals after him. And nothing was done. I mean, all of this happened whilst Bill Barr was previously Attorney General. And, you know, when other people, you know, Loretta Lynch, Holder, all those sorts of people were Attorney Generals. Why? What was going on? The American people need to know. There needs to be an explanation provided about this. But for one, I would not be surprised if one of the things that has made these investigations start to take, you know, gain more energy and more traction is the fact that there has been yet another change at the top of the Justice Department. So all I'm going to say about that. Now, coming back to Hunter Biden and the Hunter Biden investigation, before I talk about the special counsel issue, I really must make one important point, which is that two people in particular have had their reputations heavily smeared and have been accused of being conduits for Russian disinformation because of their coverage of the Hunter Biden affair. One of them, of course, was Rudy Giuliani. The other was John Solomon, who is a journalist, and he was pushed off the hill. He investigated the role that Hunter Biden had in Burisma. He did a lot of coverage. He was pushed off the hill. His reputation was trashed. I think it's high time that people started to acknowledge that John Solomon, who is an outstanding journalist, actually did an outstanding job in his coverage of the Hunter Biden scandal. And so far, and they should not only take back all those criticisms they made of him, they should actually apologize to him. I'm not holding my breath, but I want to say that because it always upsets me when somebody is criticized in that way for doing an outstanding job. Now, special counsel for the Hunter Biden investigations, it cries out for it. There are clearly multiple conflicts of interest here. Hunter Biden is the son of the man who is now legally president-elect. I'm choosing my words carefully. He is the person who is, according to the rules that we have, the person who is most likely to be inaugurated on the 20th of January. He was vice president of the United States. He will be the chief executive appointing the attorney general and the senior people of the Justice Department. Those people who will be running the Justice Department, assuming he becomes president on 20th of January, will be answerable to him, to Joe Biden, who will then be president of the United States. It's clear to me that you cannot have a situation where the Justice Department, in that kind of situation, conducts the investigation itself. You would have investigators supervised by Justice Department officials investigating the son of their own boss. I just don't see how that can possibly work. And now we're having further evidence. At the moment, it is only evidence. It's not proof, but evidence leads to proof. There is evidence that things like the sort of things that Tony Bublinski was saying, that Hunter Biden was working partly, at least, on behalf of his father, Joe Biden, may be true. So again, you have Justice Department investigators supervised by senior Justice Department officials investigating not just the son of the boss, but the boss himself, the person who appointed them. That is an impossible situation. It cries out for special counsel. I am sure, personally, that there will be special counsel to investigate this affair. The only question is who? Who will that be? Now, if special counsel is appointed, can Joe Biden sack that person? I think we have clearly established over the course of the Mueller investigation that the president can sack, does have the power to sack special counsel. But remember, the Democrats alleged over the course of the Mueller investigation, and Mueller himself investigated this concern, this allegation, that the president sacking special counsel when special counsel is either investigating him or investigating people close to the president is obstruction of justice. Now, I didn't think that made any kind of sense in the Russiagate probe because, as we've discussed many times, in the Russiagate probe, there was no underlying crime. And in fact, there was very extensive cooperation between the president and his administration and the special counsel's office, something which even Mueller acknowledged. But if you follow that kind of logic, for the president of the United States to sack special counsel who is investigating his son and plausibly himself on substantial and serious allegations of financial irregularities, of accepting backhanders, of working with a company which is, to be very clear, a front for the Chinese government. If you sack that special counsel, then on the Democrats' own logic, that is obstruction of justice. Now, I don't think that in that case it would just be on the Democrats' logic, because there is an actual underlying crime which is being investigated. I think in that sort of case, the assertion of obstruction of justice would be true. And that would give rise to potential impeachment of the president. So that's what I think about this. I am sure we will see special counsel over the next few weeks. If it doesn't happen, then it will be even further proof that Donald Trump is not in control of his own Justice Department. I think it would be very unwise indeed for Joe Biden to sack that special counsel once that special counsel is appointed. In terms of special counsel with Russiagate, John Durham, the invisible man, the man of one photograph, the Wizard of Oz figure we've been hearing so much about, but who might not even really exist in any real form. Well, I think Joe Biden could probably sack him, and he might be able to get away with it because the media would back him. But I think if special counsel is appointed and looks into Huntergate, let's call it that, Huntergate, and more things start to appear, and we find that there were genuine issues to investigate, issues of tax evasion, money laundering, close dealings with the Chinese authorities. And as I said, this company is clearly a front for the Chinese government, possibly trafficking allegations too. They've been floated. Money was sent to people in China, in Russia and Ukraine, who, for reasons that we don't completely understand, we don't have full details of, but which the Senate committees have floated theories about, serious theories about. If all that happens and that special counsel is then dismissed, yes, Joe Biden as president would have the power to do it. But the Democrats themselves have said that in that kind of situation, it would be obstruction of justice, and it would justify the impeachment of the president of the United States.
I'm wondering who this benefits. And I say it in this way. We know that there is still some time, and I'm reading some of the live stream as it's going down. Yes, we're going to get the final outcome of the elections, according to the, if I'm not mistaken, according to the Constitution. Actually, the Constitution probably says on January 20th, but we're going to know from the Senate and from Congress on the 6th.
Yes.
And that's when we'll have 99.999% of this resolved.
Yes.
Barr was obviously a roadblock.
Yes.
He was a roadblock for Trump getting things done. He may have also been a roadblock for the Democrats. He was definitely not a roadblock for Mitch McConnell. He was probably, in all chances, working with Mitch McConnell to get the Republican establishment's agenda pushed forward. So I'm trying to think, is getting Barr out of the way and perhaps appointing a special counsel a Trump initiative, so that Trump has another, another bullet in his gun to push for a different result come January 6th, maybe a result where, the House votes, which is something which I think is probably his last avenue, procedural avenue towards winning re-election. But could it be a play from the Democrats as well, in that we know that the Obama machine and the Democrats, they wanted Kamala from the very beginning, and Biden was just simply a vessel to get a terrible candidate into the Oval Office in Kamala Harris? Is this a play from the Democrats once again to sow doubt in Joe Biden and to perhaps push Biden out of the way and get Kamala in? I'm trying to see if, I can see how this definitely benefits Trump and what Trump is aiming for, and the Trump legal team and the Trump movement, how it benefits them in their reelection efforts. But this also definitely benefits the Democrat establishment as well, in that it helps them once again, get Biden out of there and get Kamala in. I mean, it's kind of working in both people's favor. Maybe I'm saying it wrong. Maybe I'm not making sense. What do you think?
Well, first of all, before we discuss the politics of it, let me stress again, I think it is absolutely the right thing to do. I think appointing special counsel, even if there were no partisan advantages to Trump, to the Republicans, or to the Democrats, it should be done, because the nature of these allegations and the way in which there is a clear conflict of interest cries out for a special counsel investigation. That is the first thing. Now, let's talk about the Democrats, because to me, that is the really important thing here. I think that there are some people in the Democratic Party who are thinking in exactly the way that you said. Of course, the Democrats have known about Joe Biden and about the kind of things that members of his family have been up to. Bear in mind, many of these things happened in open view. Hunter Biden was traveling to China on Air Force Two. I mean, there was no real attempt to keep this secret by the Bidens. Everybody, I mean, you know, Washington is the beltway, the political world of Washington. It's a very small place. People know each other. Joe Biden was for many years a member of the Senate. You know, senators know each other. Their staff, their people mix and talk with each other. The same would be true of when he was vice president. His staff would have mixed with Obama's staff. There would have been gossip. Everybody would have known within the Democratic Party what Joe Biden and Hunter Biden were up to. It's inconceivable that they didn't. And we now have, moreover, cables, the text of cables from the US Embassy in Kiev, from people like Jeff Pyatt, who was the ambassador there, who also openly talking about the Hunter Biden's activities in Ukraine, and these were being forwarded to the administration. So, of course, the Democrats knew, and yet they decided to go with this deeply compromised candidate. And why did they do that? Well, at one level, I'm sure they said to themselves, well, none of our other people look remotely convincing. With Joe, who's been around for a long time, you know, he's sort of reasonably personable individual. Perhaps we have a chance of getting him over the line and getting him elected. So there may have, no doubt, there was some of that. But surely they would have known that this is a bomb, electing Joe Biden, a bomb that was sooner or later going to explode. And quite possibly, in fact, very plausibly, they wanted that. And that was one of the reasons why they picked him, because they knew that he is so compromised that he wouldn't remain president for very long. And if you take the view, which I do, and I remember many of the things that were being said in early to mid 2019 about how Kamala Harris was the coming person and that she was the preferred choice. They found out during the primaries that Kamala Harris had no prospect of winning an election. They tack her on to Joe Biden, get Joe Biden to bring Kamala Harris across the line as VP. And then, of course, the bomb explodes under Joe Biden. He has to go. His position becomes untenable. And the way is open for the person they always wanted, Kamala Harris, to step in as president. It wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, there are certainly people in the Democratic Party who think in exactly that way.
If, you know, and this may be the Trump way to once again push towards a January 6th decision. Who knows? I mean, I'm always trying to figure out, and we'll leave the live stream here. I'm always trying to figure out exactly who's benefiting from all of this. I mean, maybe both sides are benefiting. Maybe one's a distraction and, you know, it's look here, but actually it's the Democrats that are coordinating the ultimate demise of a Biden presidency, even though we're led to believe this is about Trump and Barr and special counsel into Hunter, and a offensive move by the Republicans. Maybe in essence, this really is a way for the Democrats to orchestrate once again Biden's rule. But maybe it is also the Trump legal team or the Trump team in general just saying, you know what, let's go forward with the Hunter special counsel. Worst case scenario, we severely impede Joe Biden presidency. Best case scenario, we sow more doubt come January 6th and once again, maybe pull off the miracle. Let's call it the Hail Mary, which is, get this to a House vote.
I have to say straight away that the problem about getting the House to change position is that it needs the support of at least one senator. And of course, Mitch McConnell has acted to try to stop that happening. I just want to say that. But there was an extraordinarily interesting article in the Washington Examiner, which, remember, is a Republican establishment news site, which has been critical and hostile to Trump over the last few weeks. But it admitted for the first time that, assuming Joe Biden does become president, Donald Trump looks like is well positioned to become something that has never existed in the United States before, which is the leader of the opposition. I mean, he would actually be the sort of anti-president. And if you think of him in that kind of way, then having special counsel investigations of Joe Biden, obviously there's Durham. We don't know what's coming of that. Maybe nothing will. But certainly of Hunter and Huntergate, politically, that would be a gift for him. He could play with that relentlessly for all it was worth. So, yes, if you're looking at this in strictly partisan terms, and you should, because to be very clear, legal investigations at this level don't operate in a vacuum. Politics always goes on, and it's proper and correct that we look at at that aspect of these things. If you look at this in partisan terms, then this plays to Trump massively, and he will use it. But I repeat again that regardless of that, appointing special counsel is the obvious, correct, and right thing to do. I would go further. I would say it is the essential thing to do. If it doesn't happen, it will be very bad.
Yeah, I tend to think that whatever the outcome come January 20th, they've made Trump more powerful than they realize. I really believe that Trump is going to be, he's just become such a much more powerful force to deal with.
Well, what was that wonderful line in the Star Wars?
Star Wars, where Darth Vader is about to take out Obi-Wan. And Obi-Wan.
Says,
some of the live stream will put that exact quote where Obi-Wan says, you're going to make me a lot more powerful than you could imagine. So, yeah.
Something of that kind. So, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the point to understand is that there is a Trump movement in the country, which is independent of the Republican leadership. That's, by the way, something that the Republican leadership is very, very nervous and worried about, I should say. But it exists there. It is active right across the United States. It is present everywhere in the United States. The Republicans on the back of Trump's campaign actually started to make inroads in California, where, by the way, in my opinion, there is ample grounds for a Republican breakthrough if it's organized properly. Problem has been that the Republican Party has written off California. That's my own personal view. I know now lots of people will disagree, but that's another story. But there is a Trump movement, and there is the person of Donald Trump. He can certainly come out of this far more powerful as a political force than he has ever been before.
Yeah. All right, great. We'll leave it there. I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about. I have something that I want to talk to you about very quickly. Let's do it. We don't have many super chats, a couple. Let's do a couple super chats. And I want to ask you real quick about Assange. So we have four super chats. Let's wrap those up. And then I want to ask you about Assange very, very quickly. From Triumph 951000. All right. I caught the live stream. You guys do fantastic work. We look forward to all your broadcasts. Thank you very much for that super chat. From Andrew Cole. Thank you for your hard work. Happy Christmas. Thank you, Andrew, for that. Happy Christmas to you as well. From Dan Noyes regarding Justice Roberts, common knowledge in the adoption community that his children are Irish, illegally adopted through Guatemala. Okay, that's interesting. And another one from Dan Moyes, a $10 super chat. We are Trump is us, not a politician. We work, we sacrifice, we risk it all. The opposite of everything in DC. Next time, lock down the government and stop their paychecks. Leave us alone.
I've never heard people in the United States talk about any other political leader in that way. And that is the difference. That's something that is new in the modern politics of the United States. No doubt it's existed before. I'm sure if you went back far enough, you'd find people talk like that, maybe about FDR, maybe about Lincoln, maybe about Andrew Jackson.
A little Reagan.
But certainly not to this extent and in this sort of way. And in politics, something like that is a force. It's a power. It's a force to be reckoned with. And when it's reproduced, the 74 million people voted in that way. Well, that tells you something about the state of the United States. I always come back to what I always say. Councils of despair are bad councils. There's everything to play for in this situation.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent super chat, Dan. Thank you very much for that. A student from Spring, Essel Growth at $10 super chat. Thank you for your valuable insights as always. Thank you very much for that. And one more super chat from James Jackman. Trump didn't declassify 9/11 cover up, or did he, Alex? No, I don't believe he did.
I don't think he did. No, I don't think he
Trump,
did.
Trump. If there's one thing that 9/11 is one, but big tech was another big mistake. He didn't go after big tech when he should have, and it cost him. It cost him dearly. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. So yeah, there's a lot to look back on and to self correct. Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for that super chat as well. And from Charlie, a $20 super chat. Merry Christmas to both of you. Thanks for the great work as always. Keep it up. P.S. I got my copy of The Origins of the Polynesian War. Thank you for the recommendation. I will be asking for more in the future. Thank you very much, Charlie, for that super chat. Awesome. And Alexander, let's just wrap it up real quick with Julian Assange. What's your take on it? You know what? There was a tweet. Mm. It was a false tweet. It was wrong. Pastor, I forgot who tweeted it, who started it off, but Pastor something. If someone in the live stream knows, just to throw it in there. He said that he heard rumors that Assange was going to be pardoned. And everything blew up, and everyone was saying, oh, Trump is going to pardon Assange. He backtracked. He sent the tweet a couple hours later. He said, wrong. My sources were wrong. It's not going to happen. But you know what? It reignited the push to get Assange pardoned. So even though it was a false tweet, I think it did do us a great service in that it reignited the push to get Assange pardoned. Assange did send he has actually asked for a pardon. His fiance was on Tucker Carlson Tonight. Yeah, she's pushing for the pardon as well. We also have from Project Veritas a leaked audio call between Assange and the attorney at the State Department, where Assange shows the caliber of journalist that he really is, and that he had documents. He was preparing a document dump about information that he had in the State Department, but he wanted to make sure he had redacted various people's names so as to not put them in harm. Unfortunately, an ex-employee that WikiLeaks had fired had gotten hold of the documents, and they were going to dump those documents without redactions. So Assange took it upon himself to call the attorneys at the State Department. We have that audio phone call. Assange tells them, look, this is going to go down. We've redacted everything. We're going to help you track down this ex-employee so we make sure he doesn't publish this information. We don't want to put lives in danger. The State Department told him, thank you, Mr. Assange. It's great. Please help us out. We need your help. I mean, I think it really shows the caliber of journalist Assange really was. What do you make of all this information, this new push to get Assange pardoned?
Well, the first thing I just want to deal first with that, the last thing about this call between Assange and this U.S. attorney, this official. Because to my mind, in legal terms, in terms of the extradition case, it is absolutely crucial. It is critical evidence, because if you follow the recent trial, I'll call it a trial, it's technically an extradition hearing, in London, one of the very fascinating things about it is that the US authorities came and they made all kinds of allegations against Assange. But over the course of the trial, it became ever more restricted to one specific issue, which is that Assange recklessly put the lives of US informants and sources at risk by publishing controversial information about them. And Assange's legal team vigorously disputed this and said that he'd never done any such thing. And the US authorities, their evidence that he had recklessly let that happen basically boiled down to allegations in a book by two Guardian journalists who are known to have been hostile to Assange. So this conversation goes directly to that issue, because it shows that so far from Assange recklessly putting the lives of sources and informants at risk, he was doing all he could to try to protect them. Now, about this individual who was in the process of leaking all this information, this disaffected ex-employee, I think I know who that is. And I should say again that if it is who I think it is, the strange thing about this man is that he's a criminal himself and a convicted fraudster. He is also, and this is one of the strangest aspects about the case, a US government witness in the case against Assange. So that shows you how distorted and lopsided this whole case against Assange is. The evidence of a person who actually put the sources at risk and who has a criminal background is the evidence that is being used by the US authorities against Assange in order to try to prove that it was Assange who put the lives of sources at risk. It makes no sense and it doesn't add up. It's come, unfortunately, this information has come, unfortunately, after the trial. It's one of the problems with the trial was that it was held in such a hurry and at such speed that Assange's defense had difficulties getting all the evidence together in time. And of course, there were many problems put in their way to do it. I mean, problems of consulting with Assange and those sort of things. It's a shame this evidence wasn't produced at the trial, because to my mind, it shoots the whole case down. It knocks it to pieces, and it ought to make it much more likely that when the appeal comes, Assange will win the appeal. Now, that's what I want to say about the legalities of this. Pardon, and that there is a push now to get Trump to pardon Assange. Of course there should be. This information demonstrates conclusively that Assange himself was not trying to put anybody's life at risk. And as I said, that was the entire case against him. Given that that is so, by the US government's own criteria, he is an innocent man, and therefore he should be pardoned. I hope Donald Trump does it. I hope he's listening. Well, maybe he's not listening, but I hope people who are close to him are listening. I think this is entirely in his interests to do that. I think he will win a lot of support, obviously not from the political class in Washington who hate Assange, but who hate Donald Trump anyway. But it will gain him a lot of support and goodwill amongst people generally, and it will also put the media in the United States and in Britain in a very difficult position, because though they detest and loathe Assange and want him to be sent to the United States and punished there, in theory, partly in their own interests and partly in order to appease their readers and viewers, they have to go through the motions of saying that they oppose the case against Assange. So it would be a wonderful way of putting the media itself on the spot. So I think both for moral reasons and for legal reasons and also for political reasons, Donald Trump should do it.
All right, let's wrap it up with some more super chats here from Dan Noyes. You kids are great. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much, Dan, for that. From Rhubarb Pie, a $20 super chat. Thank you very much for that. From Henry, 10 euro super chat. Support new media truth. Avoid fake media. Thank you very much for that super chat, Henry. From James Jackman, Assange is Australian. Trump can't pardon anyone that isn't a U.S. citizen, or am I mistaken?
Well, I'm not sure about this. That may be true, but he can give instructions to have the entire case against Assange ended. I think on balance, actually, I'm thinking about this, that this is said entirely off the top of my head. I would have thought that if the United States can prosecute Assange for a federal offense, then the president can pardon someone, because he has the power to pardon anybody who is convicted of a federal offense, or at least bring proceedings against that person to an end.
All right. Mimi Shevanovich sent us a super sticker. Thank you very much for that. Coffee. And the final one is from Robert, $9.99. Just another education for myself. Friends dislike Farage because he quit the party after the Brexit vote. Can you explain why he didn't try to lead after the vote?
I think that was a major mistake. We've discussed this many times. I think even Farage admits that he made a terrible mistake when he did that. I think he was very tired. I think he'd been fighting for Brexit for many, many years. He'd built up his party and was a very, very difficult thing to do. He was facing constant criticism from all sides. I think he made the mistake of thinking in 2016 that with the Brexit referendum won, he could go back, lead a normal life, return to business, and start being, you know, an ordinary person again. And can I just say something? One of the great attractions that Farage has for many people in Britain is precisely that he is not a politician. He is not someone who's interested in power for himself. He is someone who is committed to a cause. So, yes, it was a big mistake to leave in 2016. But in fact, the fact that that he made that mistake shows you why people like him. Most political leaders, when they're winning, stay on because they want to go on winning and they want to achieve power. Farage said, I've won. I've achieved what I set out to achieve. Therefore, I can go back to normal life. It was a huge mistake. I don't think he realized how entrenched the Remain establishment in Britain is. I don't think he remotely realized how contemptuous they are of the votes of British people. And I'm afraid by quitting the scene when he did, he allowed lots of things to happen, which perhaps if he'd still been there, he'd still been campaigning, they wouldn't have happened. When he came back in 2019, reformed a party, his Brexit party, started campaigning against Theresa May's decision to basically go for a Brexit that wasn't a Brexit. I mean, he transformed the political landscape in Britain. Within a few weeks, his party swept the board at the European elections, and Theresa May, within a few weeks, was out. So that shows you the extraordinary political power that he has. He made a mistake in 2016. But it was the sort of mistake that also shows you his extraordinary political strength.
All right. And welcome, Ernest Gibson, new member to the Durant community. Let's wrap it up there. Spartan Warrior Queen, thank you very much for your amazing and awesome moderation. Once again, we really, really appreciate it. The best moderator in all of YouTube, in all the universe. And what else? Go to the Durant shop, guys. Pick up some merchandise. Durant shirts, mugs, all kinds of great things. I've got a classic shirt. You've got a sweatshirt.
Mugs, this one with Dimitri's graphics there. And, of course, all the amazing things you can get from our shop. Our hats and hoodies and stickers and whatever. So, yes, come to our shop. Support us that way. Support us on our other platforms. Come to and support us on Patreon, Subscribestar, and through PayPal. And thank you very much.
We have a Discord server. Check that out. Guys, if you're not subscribed to my channel, Alex Christofori, check that out. I'll subscribe to that. BitChute, Odyssey, and Rumble. We are on Rumble. You'll find all the links down below. Also, check your subscriptions with YouTube as well. Make sure you're still subscribed to us on YouTube so that maybe you have the chance of getting a notification if YouTube is very kind to us and decides to send notifications to stuff. And that's it. We'll leave it there. Have a great weekend, everybody. And maybe we will be jumping on for a live stream to talk about Putin's annual press conference. It was an interesting one. Boy, did he say a lot of interesting things.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And welcome, Henry, new member to the Durant community. Welcome, Henry. Good to have you here. All right, everybody. Take care. Have a great evening and have a restful weekend. Yeah. Oh, wait, we got one more. Do we have one more from Art B. Pam? Another super chat. Thank you for that. Take care, everybody. Yeah.